is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 26, 2006. I'm Nell Abram. Official election results are in, and Hamas has captured the majority of seats in the Palestinian parliament. IBM gets sued for allegedly not paying overtime to thousands of workers. And the execution of a Florida man is stayed in an action that could stop the use of lethal injection in the United States. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A South Korean court today ordered chemical companies Monsanto and Dow to pay over $65 million in damages to South Korean veterans of the Vietnam War. The two companies manufactured dioxin-laced defoliants used in large quantities by U.S. forces. Dioxin exposure can cause severe illness, birth defects, and cancer. Similar lawsuits brought against Agent Orange manufacturers by U.S. veterans were settled out of court. India's foreign secretary scolded the U.S. ambassador in India today for comments the foreign ministry calls, quote, inappropriate and not conducive. Vinod K. Jose reports from New Delhi.
The Press Trust of India news agency reported yesterday that the United States ambassador to India, David Mulford, said in an interview that a nuclear deal with India could die if New Delhi does not support the U.S. against Iran in the International Atomic Energy Agency vote on February 3rd. President Bush and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh signed a civilian nuclear cooperation agreement last year. But even after many rounds of official talks and couple of visits by the U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns, the agreement has not progressed further. Soon after Mulford's comment yesterday, many Indian political parties reacted, calling it outrageous. And U.S. administration distanced itself from ambassador's statement, calling it his personal opinion. The Indian government asserted it would proceed on the basis of its own independent judgment on Iran and rejected linking Iran vote to nuclear deal with the U.S. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
In Nepal, agitating political parties called for a countrywide shutdown today, and the government responded by arresting hundreds of protesters. From Kathmandu, Carrie Byron reports.
The capital streets were unusually filled with people this morning. Unlike in previous days and weeks, however, those streets were eerily quiet, with little slogan chanting or violence. With the institution of a nationwide banda, or unofficial curfew, stores, factories, and schools are shut down throughout the day, while both public and private transport is barred from the streets. Called by the country's dispossessed political parties, today's banda is meant to show support for the party's calls to release political leaders arrested earlier this week. Today also coincides with the nomination of candidates for the upcoming municipal elections, which the parties are boycotting as undemocratic. While cooperation with a banda is meant to show solidarity, most of its effectiveness comes through intimidation. Today's shutdown comes less than a week after the government imposed its own full-day curfew last Friday for security reasons, and follows almost daily skirmishes between protesters and security forces. While today's quiet streets are arguably a show of some political strength, they are unarguably another in a long string of disruptions in the everyday lives of Nepalese. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
In Iraq, U.S. forces released five women prisoners today. Officials denied that the timing was related to demands made by the captors of Christian Science Monitor journalist Jill Carroll. The journalist's captors threatened to kill her unless Iraqi women held in U.S. custody were freed. There has been no word of Carroll since her kidnappers released a video of her last week. The daughter of Chile's former dictator, Augusto Pinochet, has requested political asylum in the U.S., after her arrest yesterday in Washington's Dulles International Airport. Lucio Pinochet is wanted by the Chilean courts on charges of tax evasion and documents fraud. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has the story.
Interior Minister Francisco Vidal was visibly angry when informed of Lucia Pinochet's intent to seek protection in the U.S. on grounds of alleged political persecution. Lucia Pinochet fled the country after she was summoned to appear in court this week alongside four family members for charges stemming from the Riggs Bank scandal. She was detained yesterday as she attempted to enter the U.S. Foreign Minister Ignacio Walker says he's certain U.S. authorities will deny Lucia Pinochet's asylum request. The rest of the accused members of the Pinochet family are free on bail. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garrotón in Santiago.
A New York activist charged with conspiracy, property destruction, and arson was released yesterday on $1.6 million bail. Daniel McGowan is suspected of having participated in arson attacks against an Oregon tree farm and a lumberyard in 2001. FBI agents arrested McGowan last month. Evidence in the case against him is reportedly based on testimony from confidential informants. At yesterday's hearing, the prosecution argued against McGowan's release, saying that he posed a serious flight risk. As he awaits trial, McGowan must abide by a court-imposed curfew, live with his sister, and wear a monitoring device. Although no injuries or deaths resulted from the arsons, McGowan could face life in prison if convicted. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Official U.S. budget and economic projections reveal optimism, noting that the economy is strong and the deficit will turn into a surplus in 9 to 10 years. But if the level of spending remains consistent and President Bush's tax cuts are made permanent, a large deficit and debt will remain. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
The federal deficit for 2006 is projected to hit $337 billion, and that doesn't include extra spending for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and extra money for hurricane cleanup. The need for all is very likely. Those costs could bring the deficit to $360 billion this year, which falls in between the 2004 and 2005 deficit levels. Projections show that the deficit will improve. The numbers released by the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, a nonpartisan research leg of the government, said that the economy is also expected to continue to grow for the next couple of years, then slow slightly, and that in 10 years a surplus of revenue from $40 to $60 billion is expected. Donald Marin of the Congressional Budget Office.
This is a chart which I will emphasize a lot in my discussion, which shows outlays relative to the size of the economy and revenues relative to the size of the economy. And so everyone understand that the deficit would be the difference between these two bars. And the basic story is one in which the two lines are getting closer together. That narrows over time. Revenues grow faster than the economy. Spending under the rules that we use to project what spending will be grows slightly slower than the economy. That causes the deficit over time to decline.
The three largest programs that cost the most, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, will consume 8.6% of the budget in 2006. In 10 years, 10.6% of the budget. That's because baby boomers will begin retiring in 2008. But the budget is expected to become balanced even with a large increase of mandatory spending. Again, Marin.
As the tax provisions expire, as tax increases come into effect, in 2011 in particular, you see a big increase in revenues, and basically we get back to a forecast where the deficit is small, and then actually we get small surpluses.
The president's tax cuts are expected to expire in 2007. The CBO takes into account spending bills that have already been passed and omitting proposed spending agenda that has not yet been signed into law. But next week, President Bush will give his State of the Union address where he is expected to push for two reconciliation bills. One of the bills includes $40 billion in spending cuts, mostly from social programs, and the other makes permanent the tax cuts. Both have passed the House and the Senate, but have not been finalized. If both of those are implemented, the budget deficit will remain. Jim Horney is a senior economist with the Center of Budget and Policy Priorities.
If the reconciliation spending bill were enacted, it would reduce spending by a little less than $40 billion over the next 5 years. You also have to keep in mind, though, that the reconciliation process won't really lead to deficit reduction because there's a second reconciliation bill that has tax cuts. The tax cuts are expected to total $70 billion. So when you put together the spending bill and the tax reconciliation bills together, the reconciliation package would increase the deficit by more than $30 billion over the next 5 years.
The projection, along with other plans the president is proposing, including a change in the tax that was created to tax the most wealthy, defense spending, and the cost of war, The deficit could reach more than $3 trillion in 10 years. Ranking Democrat on the Budget Judiciary Committee, Kent Conrad.
They hold the majority in both the House and the Senate. They control the White House. The first thing we've got to do is try to stop their package. That's the only way that we would have any possibility of passing an alternative. Their fiscal policy has taken us down the road to exploding debt.
The debt, which is an accumulation of deficits since 2001, is expected to reach $637 billion this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Palestinian election officials now say Hamas has won 76 seats in the 132-member parliament in yesterday's vote, and the Palestinian government has resigned following the first elections there in a decade. Despite earlier fears of violence, the voting went smoothly at more than 1,000 polling stations across Gaza, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. Today, however, Hamas supporters clashed with Fatah loyalists when they raised their flag over the Palestinian parliament building. Iris Mackler went to Ramallah to see thousands join in Hamas victory parades.
Ramallah is the seat of government of Palestinian ruling party Fatah. But this afternoon, after Fatah conceded defeat in Wednesday's historic elections, the streets were a sea of Hamas green. Thousands waved Hamas flags, sang Hamas songs, and shouted, Allahu Akbar. When the parade reached the parliament, they removed the Palestinian national flag and replaced it with one from Hamas. This act alone is symbolic of the revolution Hamas has created in Palestinian politics. Their stunning upset victory seemed to take many on the streets of Ramallah by surprise, since all the polls had predicted a Fatah win. We were really shocked. We support Fatah, say these two soldiers from Jenin, so we were shocked and disappointed. It seems this was as much a vote against Fatah as for Hamas. Disenchantment with Fatah was severe, especially with the corruption and nepotism which it allowed to run rampant in the Palestinian Authority. People here were also fed up with the anarchy and lawlessness and the battles between various branches of the security services.
Yeah, it is kind of punishment for the authority and for Fatah. It's kind of judgment.
Nadil Khatib is a puppeteer who travels to villages around Ramallah, performing for poor children. At the rally, he argued that Palestinians suffered as much from the authority as from Israel.
The people say here in Palestine, majority, enough with corruption first and then the occupation.
Most people here said they simply wanted change, and they've certainly got that. The Hamas victory has caused consternation inside Israel. Right-wing politicians, including Yuval Steinitz, chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of Israel's parliament, says Israel should never have allowed the vote to occur in the first place. Steinitz says Israel has created Hamastan on its doorstep. Others on the right say the Hamas success is a direct result of Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. Israel's acting prime minister is convening high-level cabinet meetings to decide how Israel will deal with this new reality. There are also international implications. Hamas is on Washington's list of terror organizations, and the US says it will not deal with a Hamas government, nor fund the Palestinian Authority if it has a Hamas leadership. Washington and the European Union say Hamas will have international support if it renounces violence. The ball, they say, is in Hamas's court. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Following the announcement of the official election results, Hamas proposed a collaborative approach to Fatah leaders in the form of a national unity government. Manar Jibreen reports from Bethlehem.
Paving the way for a new government to be formed, President Mahmoud Abbas accepted the resignation of Prime Minister Ahmed Quraya and asked that the current government continue to serve as a caretaker government until a new one is formed. Following its election victory, Hamas turned to the Fatah movement and offered a joint framework of a national unity government. The offer was made during a telephone call between Hamas political bureau head Khaled Mash'al and Palestinian President Abbas, who congratulated Mash'al on the movement's victory in the elections. Fatah said the possibility of joining a unity government will be discussed soon. It is the first time that Fatah loses power to another group since founded in 1964. While Fatah's defeat was a comparatively close one, leftist liberal parties and independent candidates have apparently suffered a devastating electoral blow. According to the latest results, all the leftist parties won 9 seats and 4 went to independent candidates. Some say Fatah's internal problems and lack of guidance is what led to their electoral defeat. Fuad Kokeli, spokesman of Fatah in Bethlehem area and a newly elected parliament member, said Fatah needs to reorganize and reconsider its programs and visions.
The results were surprising. None of us expected that Hamas would win this large number of seats. I believe this is a lesson that Fatah should learn from. We have to reassess our programs and vision and reorganize the movement. Therefore, we will be in the opposition and will continue to work to serve our people. I consider the results positive and a victory for the Palestinian democracy. I believe Hamas will form the government and will have to deal with the local and international requirements because it cannot do otherwise.
For FSR and from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin reporting from Bethlehem.
In a decision that could temporarily halt executions by lethal injection across the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked the execution of Florida inmate Clarence Hill, who was convicted of killing a police officer in 1982. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer reports.
Clarence Hill was already strapped to a gurney with IV lines running into his arms and was almost 1 hour past the scheduled time of his death when word came down that Justice Anthony Kennedy had stayed his execution. On Wednesday morning, the entire Supreme Court continued the stay, which means the execution will not take place at least until April when oral arguments are heard. Hill's lawyers had filed several legal challenges, but the one the court decided to hear pertains to whether lethal injection causes pain, thereby violating the Constitution's clause against cruel and inhuman punishment.
Lethal injection is basically, it's a medical charade.
Dr. John Groner is an associate clinical professor at Ohio State University College of Public Health. He's been studying lethal injection for several years.
It involves giving an ultra-short-acting barbiturate followed by a drug that completely paralyzes all muscles so that the inmate is rendered unable to communicate discomfort if it's occurring. There is no science to the way that this is done, that that's never been tested, people aren't monitored, and that once that Pavilion, that second drug, is in, the inmate looks serene. Well, what's going on in the inside, you can't tell because it paralyzes all muscles, including muscles of expression. So someone is basically lying there, not twitching, not moving, not breathing, but could be having, raging, agonizing pain inside.
The Supreme Court is not considering the question of lethal injection itself, but instead will decide two questions about whether federal courts should hear Hill's challenge on civil rights grounds. If the Supreme Court rules in Hill's favor, it's the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta, which will then have to consider if lethal injection is cruel and inhumane.
It's fine, because we're not having any executions for the time being.
Abe Bonowitz, with Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, says he's almost positive next week's scheduled execution of Vietnam veteran Arthur Rutherford will be postponed in the wake of the ruling, and he's hopeful the stay might cause a moratorium in all 35 states which use lethal injection. Bonowitz points to 2002, when an Arizona challenge questioning the need for a jury's approval for a death sentence had repercussions nationwide.
When the Supreme Court granted cert in the Ring case, there were three executions scheduled in Florida, and the Supreme Court granted a stay in the first of those three executions. And then Governor Bush properly said, okay, well, if they're going to stay this one, they'll stay the other ones, and he just stayed the other one. And the others that were potentially impacted is they just went on a de facto temporary moratorium on executions pending the results of that case.
Florida began using lethal injection in 2000 to circumvent a legal challenge to the electric chair following several incidents where people's hair or face caught on fire during electrocution. Carolyn Snerkowski with the Florida Attorney General's office was not sure if Rutherford's execution date would be postponed and says in a worst-case scenario, Florida still has another option.
Right now, we still have the electric chair.
So have you started any discussion about whether you'd bring that back out?
No, that is not. The lethal injection has not been assailed. It's the threat of being assailed at this point.
The Supreme Court may not issue an opinion in Hill's case until this summer. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Current and former workers for International Business Machines Incorporated filed suit this week in federal court in San Francisco, accusing the high-tech giant of not paying overtime to tens of thousands of employees. Max Pringle reports.
The suit was filed in U.S. District Court on behalf of three current and former IBM workers. It seeks class action status to represent thousands more present and former computer support technicians in California and New York. Jahan Sagafi is an attorney with the San Francisco law firm Leaf, Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, which represents the workers. He says IBM violated the workers' rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The act guarantees workers time and a half for any time worked over 40 hours per week.
So these plaintiffs are alleging that the type of work that they did qualifies them under the FLSA, and that they worked more than 40 hours in a week and did not get paid overtime pay for that, and therefore deserve to be paid overtime.
Calls to IBM's corporate headquarters in New York were not returned by airtime. Typically, management-level employees and certain high-level computer technicians are exempt from overtime compensation. But the suit alleges these workers did not fit into those categories and seeks several years of back overtime pay and other remuneration. Again, Jahan Sagafi.
The compensation would be the unpaid wages of time and a half for all of those hours worked over 40, as well as injunctive relief preventing IBM from denying other workers in the future their rightful overtime pay, as well as attorney's fees and costs to cover the cost of the litigation itself.
Labor analysts say a trend has taken hold in the high-tech industry in which workers who qualify for overtime pay are being denied their due. Scott Klinger is director of the Responsible Wealth Project for United for a Fair Economy, a Boston-based labor rights organization.
Yeah, we've seen quite a trend towards people working longer and longer hours, especially relative to workers in other countries like Europe and Asia. And, you know, it's off the clock, often white-collar jobs, and certainly the phenomena of always being connected through cell phones and online email and stuff. People never get a break from their work.
Attorneys estimate that the potential financial award for the suit could reach into the tens of millions of dollars. IBM must now respond to the suit. Lawyers for the workers will then file a motion for class action certification. The case could take years to run its course. A similar case filed recently against Computer Sciences Corporation was settled for $24 million. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
India celebrated its 57th Republic Day today. Celebrations took place amid high security in the capital, New Delhi, and in other Indian states. In Indian-administered Kashmir, celebrations also took place, again with high security arrangements. Kashmiri separatist groups called for a shutdown strike. People stayed indoors, and movement on the roads was sparse. As Shahnawaz Khan reports, the Republic Day brings a lot of hassles for Kashmiris each year.
It has become an annual affair now. Security is beefed up every year in Indian-administered Kashmir for the Indian Republic Day celebrations in January and Independence Day celebrations in August. Kashmiris feel the heat of security arrangements weeks in advance. Roof Ahmed Ahangar is a resident of Srinagar.
It is not a day of celebration for us. For Kashmiris, it is a day of depression. Right from January 1st, the tension mounts. There is depression, tension, and fear. It may be a day of celebration for other Indian states, not for us. For us, the day proves expensive.
The hassles are higher for people living in the vicinity of Bakhti Stadium in Srinagar, where the Republic Day function is held. Muhammad Aslam lives in the vicinity of Bakhti Stadium.
The area around Bakhti Stadium where the Indian Republic Day celebrations will be held here in Kashmir is being sensitized from the last 2 or 3 weeks. The Indian troopers every day come and disturb our sleep early in the morning, enter our houses forcefully, go on the rooftops and guard the area for the security of their own bosses and officials and officers. We are being unnecessarily harassed.
Police search all the houses surrounding the stadium to register residents and ask people to report their guests during these days. Police authorities admit the arrangements add to the hassles. K. Rajendra is the Inspector General of Police, Kashmir.
The frequent checking and frisking is bound to cause some amount of inconvenience to common people, for which we would request them to cooperate with us. whatever we are doing is for the benefit of the people, only because we have seen in the last few years, militants have been indulging in violent acts in public places, resulting in large numbers of civilian casualties.
Traveling to other places is also difficult for Kashmiris. In New Delhi, Kashmiris are seen with suspicion, and hotels refuse to offer rooms to Kashmiris, fearing police persecution. Shahid Hussain Mir is a businessman in Srinagar who traveled to Delhi last month. Unable to find a room, Shahid returned the same day without completing the job he had gone for.
I reached Delhi on 4th December. I was refused a room by all the hotels I tried to check in. They told me they had instructions from the police not to offer any rooms to Kashmiris. I was also stopped and harassed by police. I decided it was better to return.
Kashmiri separatist groups call for a shutdown strike on Indian Republic Day to protest the Indian rule in Kashmir. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
The Environmental Working Group released a report noting that more than $143 billion has been spent on farm subsidies by the U.S. government since 1995. The Washington-based advocacy group indicates that $10 billion of that amount has been funneled to farms in North and South Dakota. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jim Kent.
The perception that many U.S. farmers are living high on the hog as a result of huge government subsidies is, at best, a tragic misconception, according to Emily Alpert, trade policy expert for Oxfam America.
The majority of subsidies go to large landowners and wealthy farmers. About 60% of farmers in the United States receive no subsidies at all. It's incredibly concentrated even amongst the farms that do receive subsidies.
South Dakota Farm Union President Doug Somke agrees with Alpert. He notes the average South Dakota farm is between 1,000 and 1,500 acres and doesn't receive anywhere near the maximum subsidy of $360,000. Somke adds that although there are no corporate farms like Archer Daniels Midland in the state, there are immense private farms.
Some of them are reaching their limit. People find a way around laws and regulations. In doing that, what they end up doing is forming corporations, and not only are they farming it in dad's name, they're farming it in mom's name, son's name, and daughter's name. And so therefore, they're double, triple, four times dipping.
SDM Farms Partnership in Fairmont, North Dakota is such an operation. The mega farm raked in more than $340,000 in subsidies in 2004. And although SDM Farms...
We do not do interviews.
...and North Dakota's Johnson Farms...
Nobody's here right now. Thanks for calling.
...were reluctant to discuss the topic, South Dakota farmer Craig DeBoer was more than willing to offer his opinion.
It's my belief that corporate farming, where the majority of the income of the corporation is not derived from farming, should not receive subsidies, yet that's not the case.
DeBoer receives just $5,000 in subsidies for his farm. He also runs an agricultural consultant business to supplement his income.
My farm receives very little. The fact that I survive is not due to those, for sure.
Henry Russell farms nearby DeBoer. Russell's subsidy amounts to about 20% of his operation's income. He raises cattle and sheep to make ends meet and notes that he doesn't know of any small farmers who are living the good life at the taxpayer's expense.
When you're a farmer, you're at it 24 hours a day. It's a good place to raise kids and have a family, but it's a very demanding job.
Unless some solution is found to the current farm subsidy program, says South Dakota Farm Union President Doug Somke, the small American farm is headed down the same corporate road as the small American business.
We're headed for a corporate world just like Walmart.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Sitting in for Out of Bogato, I'm Nell Abram at WMNF Community Radio in Tampa.